Vamos a escuchar palabras a continuación de la canciller Delcy Rodríguez cuando se refería a la actuación de CNN en español.
Las consecuencias para CNN, como ya dije en mi intervención, nosotros, aquí me acompaña el ministro de Comunicación, hemos solicitado a las autoridades venezolanas competentes que tomen acciones al respecto.
No sabemos en este momento cuánto tiempo va a durar esta sanción contra CNN, si es definitiva, si es temporal. Esperamos entonces la respuesta de las autoridades al respecto.
En Estados Unidos, la renuncia del asesor de seguridad nacional del presidente Donald Trump sigue generando noticia, especulación y análisis. Bricio Segovia reporta.
La polémica está que arde y es que no es para menos, porque un día después de que Donald Trump exigiera la renuncia de su asesor de seguridad nacional, esto es lo que ha dicho el presidente sobre Michael Flynn en esta jornada.
El general Flynn es un hombre maravilloso. Pienso que los medios le han tratado de manera muy injusta, los mismos medios a los que llamo falsos. Es muy triste que haya sido de esta manera.
Donald Trump acusa a los medios, sin embargo, fue el mismo portavoz del presidente el que señaló que Donald Trump había perdido la confianza en su asesor de seguridad nacional y por ello mismo había exigido su renuncia inmediata. Es importante, además, destacar que aún desconocemos el contenido de las llamadas que mantuvo Michael Flynn con el embajador ruso. Es un contenido, como digo, que de momento desconocemos, y eso sí, las mantuvo estas llamadas antes de que asumiera su cargo, es decir, justo en el momento en el que la inteligencia estadounidense estaba culpando a Rusia de interferir en las elecciones presidenciales. Lo que sí sabemos es que Flynn mintió sobre estas conversaciones una vez ya tenía el cargo asumido, mintió sobre estas conversaciones al vicepresidente Mike Pence y también a otros miembros del gobierno, como ha señalado la Casa Blanca. Y esto es algo que incluso le ha llegado a costar su cargo. La renuncia de Flynn es algo que, bien, pues no beneficia a la Casa Blanca en general, de hecho perjudica la imagen de la administración Trump e incluso la imagen del propio presidente. Sin embargo, pese a todos estos riesgos, Donald Trump decidió exigir sí o sí la renuncia del que fuera su asesor de seguridad nacional. Es precisamente por todo esto que es cuestionable, incluso sospechoso, toda esta polémica en torno al general Flynn, ya sea por el contenido que desconocemos de esas llamadas o bien por otros actos que también desconoceríamos a día de hoy. Entonces, dicho todo esto, ¿qué sabemos a ciencia cierta llegados a este punto? Bien, pues tan solo dos cosas. La primera, que el general Flynn mintió sobre estas llamadas con el embajador ruso. Y bien, lo segundo es que hay numerosas filtraciones que están surgiendo desde personas que tienen acceso en el día a día a pues información confidencial que surge de la administración Trump. El mismo presidente ha apuntado a través de Twitter hacia a la inteligencia estadounidense una vez más como las fuentes que estarían detrás de estas filtraciones. Tanto las filtraciones como las especulaciones que están girando en torno a la figura de Flynn también apuntan en numerosas ocasiones a Rusia, y de hecho las últimas son los presuntos vínculos, los presuntos contactos que mantuvo el equipo de campaña de Donald Trump con Rusia cuando todavía no era presidente electo de este país. A falta de pruebas, Rusia se ha mantenido al margen del asunto, señalando que se trata de una cuestión interna de Estados Unidos sobre la que prefiere no opinar, y quizá en un intento de distanciarse de estos vínculos que bien de Donald Trump con Rusia, el presidente ha lanzado un tuit en el que señala que Rusia tomó Crimea y lo hizo bajo la administración Obama. Y finaliza Donald Trump cuestionando si Barack Obama, su predecesor, no fue lo suficientemente duro con Moscú.
Y para el presidente de la Liga Demócrata de la Florida, Eladio José Armesto, la hipocresía es la principal característica de los medios de comunicación que buscan socavar al gobierno de Donald Trump y manipular la realidad. Escuchemos.
En Estados Unidos existen dos tipos de medios: medios controlados y medios independientes. Todos los medios controlados por la estructura de poder que le ha declarado la guerra al presidente Trump están diciendo que la filtración no es una violación de la ley, cuando hace escasamente unas semanas atrás todavía estaban diciendo que el hackeo por parte de WikiLeaks era una violación de la ley. Evidentemente, la hipocresía es la característica más sobresaliente de estos medios de prensa, que hacen cualquier cosa y dicen cualquier mentira, sin importar lo grande que sea, por avanzar su agenda oculta de buscar el enfrentamiento, la hostilidad y la guerra con Rusia y su pueblo, y socavar el nuevo gobierno del presidente Donald Trump. Desde el primer día, desde que el presidente Donald Trump fue inaugurado, ellos han tenido que batallar contra medios de prensa controlados, dedicados a falsificar, distorsionar y manipular la realidad. Pero, con suerte, afortunadamente, el pueblo norteamericano, a través de la Internet, viene enterándose día a día de todas las mentiras, los engaños, los embustes y los fraudes que estos medios de prensa controlados le suministran a diario al pueblo norteamericano. La Casa Blanca ha tenido que adaptar todos los procedimientos y los protocolos internos para tener en cuenta que estos medios están lanzados a la guerra en contra de esta administración y se han convertido en un partido de oposición al nuevo gobierno del presidente Donald Trump.
Por otro lado, mientras que Estados Unidos y sus aliados lanzan una poderosa campaña contra el gobierno sirio por un supuesto sufrimiento de civiles, la tan publicitada toma de la ciudad de Mosul en Irak está desplazando grandes números de personas, pero los medios corporativos se hacen de la vista gorda. El periodista Vicent Montagut se encuentra en Irbil, en el Kurdistán iraquí.
Hemos viajado hasta aquí para contarles las consecuencias de la ofensiva contra el Estado Islámico que tiene lugar en esta región. Prácticamente acabamos de llegar, pero ya hemos visto numerosos aviones de combate y helicópteros que cruzan el cielo a gran velocidad para atacar posiciones del Estado Islámico en la ciudad de Mosul. El último parte de bajas que tenemos corresponde al día de ayer, martes, y da cuenta de 11 personas muertas en ataques con mortero, otras 12 personas muertas en un atentado suicida, 13 personas ejecutadas en circunstancias todavía no aclaradas y 4 personas más muertas en ataques aéreos. En total, 40 víctimas en solo 24 horas. Todo ello está provocando, lógicamente, un desplazamiento masivo de población. La ONU calcula que han huido ya de Mosul 180.000 civiles y esta cifra va a aumentar con seguridad a medida que avance la ofensiva, porque la ONU calcula que quedan en Mosul alrededor de 750.000 personas, 750.000 civiles. Un paso más en el proceso de desintegración de Irak, prácticamente en guerra constante desde la invasión estadounidense en el año 2003.
En más noticias de Abya Yala, en el Neuquén argentino, un detenido que viene recibiendo amenazas se cosió la boca y comenzó una huelga de hambre. Él había sido testigo clave en el juicio en el que fueron condenados 27 policías por torturas. Marcelo Pascucio reporta.
El hecho sucede en la unidad de detención número 11 de Neuquén Capital. El interno Ramón Mancilla había sido testigo clave, junto al interno Cristian Ibaceta, en el juicio contra 27 policías por torturas en el 2009. Ibaceta fue asesinado en su celda poco después. Mancilla no paró de recibir amenazas y golpes. El hostigamiento se agravó últimamente tras conocerse la decisión del tribunal de anular la absolución de 5 policías imputados de torturas y ordenar la realización de un nuevo juicio. Mancilla, poco antes de coserse la boca, expresó a Farco que solo quiere salir vivo de la cárcel.
Traten y que me den una oportunidad con en el sentido de que pueda salir vivo, de que el día de mañana yo pueda decir sí, terminé la secundaria, posee una carrera. Lo mío es irme en libertad y vivo, ¿no? Como hicieron con Ibaceta.
Marcelo Pascucio, desde Neuquén Capital, para Farco.
Y así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Good evening, my friends. Afternoon and day. This is our duck here, asking you to help us find a new studio location, $500 to the one that can provide. If you know such a spot, it needs, a bathroom, electricity, ability to connect internet and telephone. Dry would be nice. We all thank you in advance for your support of this truly community-operated pirate radio station. 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Send us an email with your knowledge, frsc@freakradio.org. We thank you in advance.
And coming up next on the stream of Free Radio, it's Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, February 16th, 2017 show with special reports on the Sean Arlt information release, such as it was by the District Attorney's Office today, and being locked out of the Santa Cruz Police Department's press discussion. Stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. Want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to another edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse. I'll be with you for 2 hours and got a lot of audio to sling at you. I'm going to start pretty quickly without the usual lengthy prolegomenas or prolegomenas or preludes or whatever you want to call them. Just catching my breath. The main things that happened today for me were getting informed early in the morning of a DA's press conference announcing the results of the investigation into the police killing of Sean Arlt last October. You may remember he was shot dead by a police officer in the Santa Cruz Police Force while reportedly wielding a rake. And I got to tell you, the only evidence we have he was wielding a rake is the testimony of the four police officers, perhaps the testimony of the guy in the squad car who was a ride-along. There were three police officers and a sergeant, according to the testimony or the report of Jeff Rozell, the head district attorney, who held this press conference into a relatively small group of people in the on the second floor of the county building. And it was, I think, you know, the main media were there, and I was let in. I was surprised in a way that I was let in. I mean, I've never been a big buddy of Jeff Rozell's, though we're on, you know, amiable terms. You know, I'm a critic of how the legal system operates in this county, how the police and the sheriffs operate often, and therefore I don't think on their date list or anything of that sort. Anyway, there was one of the issues that was raised by activist Steve Argue in the past is that there was no evidence of Sean Arlt attacking the officers or what he attacked them with, other than the a picture of a metal rake, which was repeated at this news conference, and a video taken from the squad car, which the DA claimed was the only video that the police had, and it wasn't on the person of any of the officers. And he also claimed there was no video from any adjoining neighbors or people, which is perhaps understandable since it was in the wee hours of the morning or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to play Rozell's press conference for those who couldn't get to it, which is pretty much everybody but the few of us that got in. And you can come to your own conclusions. I couldn't get into the longer SCPD press conference at the community room of the Santa Cruz Police Department, but I did do some audio out front, and I'll be playing some of that, though it's not terribly enlightening about the Arlt case. It gives you some indication into at least my psyche and my political beliefs. So let's first hear from Jeff Rozell.
So there are about a dozen of us, well, maybe 15 in the room. We're talking four video people, including Wes White.
We're going to start in just a minute. Is everybody ready? Everything set up? Yeah. Good to go?
Ready.
I have an extra pen, baby.
Well, I'm about to get up the cell phone. Once you get this, people can just hit the record.
And actually, activist Wes White came over from Salinas to video this, and he was let into the room as my camera person. We were both, as I said, excluded from the larger or longer or really more relevant to the Santa Cruz population press conference by the Santa Cruz Police Department. But here's more from the Rozell event.
So we also have about looks like there are six of us in seats, and it's a relatively small room. The district attorney is holding this in, contrasted with the last time I was at such a conference, which was 20 years ago. Morning, Jeff. Jeff has arrived with two associates, a man and a woman.
I want to start by thanking all of you for coming here today. The reason that we're here is to discuss the incident and the events that took place on October 16th, 2016, in the city of Santa Cruz. And I want to talk a little bit about the specific role of the district attorney's office in this case. We're going to go through the independent investigation that was conducted by the district attorney's office. And we are going to play some videotape that captured part of the incident and play an audio that was recorded by one of the sergeant's belt recorders. So with that, I want to say that our condolences go out to the Arlt family, that this was a tragedy not only for them, but also for the community of Santa Cruz and the entire county of Santa Cruz. The specific role of the district attorney's office in this case is to make a determination about whether or not the officer who employed dangerous or deadly force in this case should be charged with a crime. And the answer, as we go through the analysis, we will talk about at the end. So specifically, we're going to talk about incidents that took place on Tuesday, October 11th, because they are relevant to what was going on with the officers when they responded on October 16th. And then we will go through the calls and the other information that is relevant on the evening or the early morning hours of October 16th. I want to start by saying that the incident on October 11th takes place at about 9:20 in the evening. Officers are dispatched to a residence that is on the corner of Chase and Getchell Streets, that when they arrive, they encounter Mr. Arlt. And the incident winds up with the officers in a physical struggle with Mr. Arlt, that the officers end up tasing Mr. Arlt, and at the conclusion, end up taking him to the county mental health facility, which is located in the county of Santa Cruz. The officers on the evening of October 16th had been made aware of the events of October 11th. They were discussed in a briefing, and they were also discussed amongst the officers for officer safety reasons. Dispatch receives a call on October 16th from the resident of this address on Getchell and Chase Streets. The call comes in as a person who is trying to enter the house, that the residents inside are afraid, and they want the police to respond to the residents immediately. At 3:36, a second phone call is made by the same person, and he indicates at this point that Mr. Arlt has gone around to the back of the house and that he is banging on the back door, trying to come in, and has threatened to kill everyone inside the residence. The officers, recognizing that this is the same person that there were discussions about on October 11th, decide that for officer safety reasons, they are going to respond with all of the available officers. They caravan over there with a sergeant and three other officers, a total of four officers. There is a person who is inside one of the vehicles on a ride-along, and that is the same vehicle that you're going to watch the videotape from when we play that shortly. They arrive at 4:39 at the residence. And when they arrive, they can see Mr. Arlt at the back of the residence with an umbrella in his hand, banging on the door and making noise. Mr. Arlt then disappears from sight. And the officers have a plan. They designate two of the officers to use less than lethal force and the other two to use lethal force should it become necessary. And they lose sight of Mr. Arlt and make a determination that for the safety of the individuals in the house and their own safety, that they need to keep a visual on Mr. Arlt. They enter the street and fan out across the street. Mr. Arlt then has gotten rid of the umbrella and armed himself with a rake. And you will see a photograph of the rake, and we will explain what that is in detail. Mr. Arl then opens the gate of the residence and advances on the officers with the rake raised above his head. Verbal commands are given to drop the weapon, to drop the rake. Mr. Arl continues his advance on the officers. The officers deploy less than lethal, that is a taser. The first officer deploys his taser, which you will hear on the audio tape, at 3:41. He then deploys a second cartridge, also at 3:41. Neither of those have any effect on Mr. Arl. The sergeant at 3:42 deploys his taser. That taser does not have an effect on Mr. Arl. Mr. Arl then continues and appears to be fixated on one of the officers, the officer who is employing deadly force or who will shortly employ deadly force. As Mr. Arl continues his advance, the descriptions are consistent that he quickens the pace and that he raises the rake even higher above his head than it was. The officers are backing up as Mr. Arl is advancing. The one particular officer who he is focused on, specifically backed up about 4 feet, was backed into a vehicle and could not retreat any farther. At this point, he fires 2 rounds from his duty weapon into Mr. Arl. The attack is over. Mr. Arl is then, immediately they call for medical response, and the officers render aid to Mr. Arl in an attempt to save his life. So those are, in a nutshell, the pertinent facts. The first, Mr. Arl is then pronounced dead after fire and medical arrive on scene at 4 o'clock. At the end of this, you will receive a timeline that lays out the relevant information, and you will receive a summary of the facts that are relevant for our determination. So you have behind me a team of folks in this office. This case was independently investigated by DA inspectors, and it has been reviewed exhaustively by district attorneys in this office, the chief deputy, and myself. And based on that, we have come to some determinations. And what I would like to do at this point is to first show the rake so that we all understand specifically the weapon that we are speaking about. And what you can see, this is the actual rake. It is a 5-foot-long rake. The metal head has 14 tines on it, each one a couple of inches long. That the head of the rake is approximately 13 to 14 inches wide. And as I indicated, this is the weapon that was raised over Mr. Arlt's head during the entirety of the time he left the gate and advanced on the officers. The second thing that I want to show you is a video of the incident. And as we go through this, if you look, it's a video that's taken at 3:30 in the morning with rain on the windshield, and it's not very clear. But what you can see if you look at it is in the upper right corner of the screen, what you'll notice is you can see a figure moving. And what that figure is Mr. Arl advancing with the rake in his hand at the officers. So at this point, I would like to play that video. What you'll notice is the beginning of the video, there is no audio. The audio will kick in at the end. And then when we're done with this, we will play the audio tape recording.
Most of this video is silent and simply is a view from the police car into a police car in front of the police car with the video in it. It's dark. You see raindrops on the car. There's some obscurity because of the light that's sort of shining from different places. I'm not sure where. And at some point, briefly, 10 seconds less, you see something in the upper right-hand corner that, if you believe it, and I don't necessarily think it's not true, it could be a figure of Arlt crossing the upper right-hand corner. And now you hear some police interchange. Not much, though. But you'll hear some of that.
Thing that we're going to play for you is the audio recording. And when you listen to the audio recording, one of the things that you will note is that from the time Mr. Arlt exited that gate with the rake up until the time the shots are fired is literally about, well, I would say, 30 seconds or so. It is a situation that unfolds very quickly and very rapidly. The other thing that you might want to take particular note of is when the tasers are deployed, they have a charge inside them that some people may confuse for a gunshot. That is not what you're going to hear. The two shots are what you hear at the end. The other sounds are the tasers being deployed. And as I indicated, the one officer at 341 deployed two separate charges that came out, and the sergeant at 342 deploys his. And then at 3:42, again, the officer that used dangerous and deadly force in this case, you will hear two shots fired from that gun. And I would like to play that at this time for you. So I would just like to say that, once again, the determination that is before us as the district attorney's office is whether or not criminal charges are appropriate to be filed against the officer who fired the two shots. And based on an independent review of the facts and circumstances of this case, as well as a legal analysis of whether the officer acted within the scope of the law, it is the determination of the Santa Cruz County District Attorney's Office that the officer was legally in a position to exercise the use of force that he did, and that it is not appropriate to file criminal charges against the officer in this case. I also want to say that specifically the officer that we are talking about is Santa Cruz Police Department Officer Eric Bailey. And as I've said before, this is based on our exhaustive independent investigation and the analysis of the state of the law in California at this time. And with that, I would like to ask if there are any questions specifically that are relevant to the determinations that the district attorney's office has to make. Mr. Norse.
Yeah, how many videos did you look at? Was this the only one?
There's a video that was captured from the car. This is the extent of the videos that are available. You watched it. And there was an audio recording, and the only audio recording was the one that you've also.
Where did the audio recording come from?
It came from a sergeant who was wearing what they commonly call a belt recorder, and he had a recorder going.
None of the other officers were recording anything? Or
no, the other, there were no other videos or audios connected to
this. Any witnesses nearby have any video?
Not that we did an exhaustive canvas of the area, and there was nothing else that came to light.
Nor the ride-along person?
The ride-along was in the car and gave a statement that is absolutely consistent with the other statements given by the officers. But the ride-along did not independently capture anything on video or audio.
And finally, why 4 months to do this?
You know, I will say this. The district attorney's office, when you have something like this that has been such a tragedy to the family and to the community, has an obligation, which we take seriously, to conduct an absolute thorough, independent, detailed investigation. An investigation that involves inspectors from our office, and an investigation that relies on others, the team that I have spoken about, in reviewing all of the evidence and reviewing the video, the audio, and looking at everything that was available in order to make a determination.
Did anyone from outside the DA's office get involved in this investigation?
This investigation is a DA's office investigation. And to follow up, just so we're clear, Mr. Norris, I do appreciate that question. It takes time to do a thorough job, and it's our job to do a thorough job. The community demands it, and that's what we did. Question.
What did the nature of the weapon, how did that factor into your determination that it was illegal to use force?
The law makes determinations when things are used. You can have common everyday items, but when they're used in a certain way, the question is, do they become a dangerous or deadly weapon? A knife would be an example. There's many legal uses for a knife, but if you put it in someone's hands and you advance on an officer, it takes on the character of a dangerous or deadly weapon under those facts and circumstances. So in this particular case, when you look at the actual rape, and when we say rape, there's a lot of descriptions that might fit under that category, but the specific relevant one is this rake, in this particular instance, used as it was used, how does that fall under the category of dangerous or deadly weapon?
Is there a precedent with this kind of rake?
You know, that's a very good question, and candidly, from the DA's perspective and the analysis that we need to do, what we're interested in is really whether this, under these circumstances, for us, qualifies as a dangerous or deadly weapon. Is it something in the hands of the person, the way it was being used or looked like it was attempted to be used, could it cause death or great bodily injury?
So the DA's office didn't look at precedent, though, at other rake-related incidents?
Yeah, when you say precedent...
Has a rake like this ever been used in a deadly manner?
The answer to that question is, throughout the country, I have no idea, and that is not necessarily something that's relevant to our determination. What's relevant is, in this particular case, was that rake, that specific rake, capable of causing death or great bodily injury in the manner that it was being used? And the answer is yes, it was.
Sure. Thanks.
Any other questions from anyone? Yes?
So no criminal charges?
That is
correct.
Did
that officer involved back again at the Santa Cruz Police Department?
You know, that is a question that is for Santa Cruz Police Department that you can ask them. Our determination is a very specific determination, and that is, was a crime committed by this officer, yes or no? And that is what our focus was. And anything else in terms of who's gone back to work, when, how, is not really relevant to what our discussion is here today.
Were the officers using body armor? Had the vests on?
Yeah, I think what you will find consistently in this county is officers, when they're out on patrol, wear bulletproof vests on their body, yes.
I think that this was the case here as well.
That is the case here as well. Any other questions by anybody about subjects germane to this discussion? Anything? Well, I thank you for your time and attention. And on the way out, you will be receiving a packet that will contain a timeline of the events and a brief summary of the facts as they took place. I thank you very much.
And that was Jeff Rozelle in the district attorney's discussion room, or whatever it's called, today on the second floor of the county building, telling about a dozen of us, what you just heard. You can call in with your thoughts, your questions, or comments on this if you want. Free Radio Santa Cruz is a call-in radio station, at least certainly my show is. And the call-in number here is 427-3772, 427-3772. I had a number of thoughts as I heard this recounting again, because I was there clearly for the when it was actually initially done. But the one thing that I walked away from the room kind of cursing myself for not asking more detail was, I did ask him, why did it take 4 months of investigation with the very limited information they had, which was they had one videotape, if that's all they had, and I heard the claim that that's all they had. I don't have any evidence that it's not. But they had this very small bit of video, and they also had a very small bit of audio. And I expect there was a lot more audio. I expect there was audio after the shooting of the police officers talking. I don't know that that's true. I didn't ask it. But, again, the question of how long, why should an investigation go from this October event take until February, particularly when the community is so concerned about it? And also, it's the excuse that Chief Vogel used for not revealing this audio and video. It really doesn't tell us much. I don't think it would have, if this audio and video was all that was taken and all that was there, and that was what was revealed, it doesn't give a lot of insight. You have to rely almost entirely on the officers' testimony themselves, and perhaps of the unnamed witness, which I note is still unnamed in the vehicle, at the unnamed residence. Maybe the residence was named in a Sentinel story, but it wasn't named in this press conference. The house where this happened, the people who called in, one would have thought they might have been watching this through the window to see what was going on outside. Maybe not. Maybe it happened so quickly that they didn't. Again, for those who missed what was happening earlier in the show, this is the official report, or I should say, closing the book on the shooting of Sean Arlt in mid-October of last year, where he was described as attacking the officers with a rake and had to be shot four times. He had to be shot by four officers. I guess he was shot twice. And he was shot dead. Now, I've talked about the policy of shooting to kill generally as some sort of counterintuitive policy. But let's assume that you've accepted that policy if you are really in a situation where there is no choice, if you are, your life is in danger. In other words, officer safety carries a lot of gray area here. Notice that in this discussion, Jeff Rozelle did not indicate how far away Sean Arlt was from Eric Bailey, the killer of Sean Arlt. It does indicate it happened very quickly. There's no mention at all of his mental health conditions, which were kind of a big issue at the time in the media. And it's strange that there was no issue of that, because maybe it's not so strange with my own preconceptions. You would, of course, perhaps throw some concern on the police department for its behavior in going after someone they knew was had psychological stress and problems, had already had a confrontation with them. And that's something that Rozelle doesn't mention at all. If you go on Santa Cruz Indie Media, you will see another perspective on this whole thing. I didn't have a chance to read it over very carefully. That's indiebay.org, Santa Cruz Indie Media. And you can look at the perspective of the person who wrote that there. He or she, I think the writer is anonymous, didn't indicate. I think it's a... It may have been a posting from the Santa Cruz Police News. That's what it says. And so maybe they are simply posting as an SCPD. Yeah, it looks that way. This is he has pictures of Officer Bailey and Chief Vogel smiling. Officer Bailey being sworn in. Officer Bailey and his father, Mark Bailey, who recently apparently retired. So there's not much new there. In 1997, there was another man who was shot dead by the Santa Cruz police. That was John Dine, also known as Happy John. He was a sort of a political protester, guy who lived in a halfway house, sort of a hippy-dippy kind of guy. Some people had negative things to say about him. I always thought he was incoherent, but he was often at a lot of the protests, particularly around the sleeping ban issue in Santa Cruz that I talk a lot about on this radio station. And he was shot dead by two police officers, also had a ride along with him at the time. Connor Carey killed John Dine with the officer over nearby, and I guess there was the bouncer from the Catalyst was with them as well. But there were many witnesses to this shooting, and I and others began interviewing those witnesses, Becky Johnson in particular. And we formed a group called, I guess it was the Committee for Full Disclosure, or Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, to find out, to see if the story of the police department, which came out within 2 hours after the shooting, which was on the corner of Soquel and Front Streets, which is right now a bank, and it was it's sort of across from the New Leaf parking lot. And there were numerous witnesses who later came to city council and swore that the account given by first the police chief, and then at that time the police chief was a man named Steve Belcher, and then by the district attorney, at that time a man named Art Danner, that Happy John Dine, as he was called, he was holding his weapon in his hands. It was in a combat stance. He was legs spread, ready to fire, and the weapon turned out to be they claimed later, a toy gun. But the independent witnesses, as I said, of whom there were at least 10, claimed one after the other that he had no weapon in his hand, and these weren't just activist friends of Happy John's either, that he wasn't in a combat stance, and that there was that was simply not their perception of what happened. Some of them were watching the situation as they drove by, went by on a bus. One woman was on the second floor of a New Leaf Market, and others were just walking by. And we had a police review board at that time that whitewashed the whole thing, as I reviewed it. They should have called for an independent investigation, and they didn't. Of course, we had no independent investigation in this case, the case of the killing of Sean Arald, either. That also has not been even proposed by the city council, the police department, or the district attorney's office. The district attorney's office is, of course, and tends to work closely with the police department. They need police department testimony for their convictions and for their cases, and it's not unreasonable to suggest that it might be a fairer situation to have someone outside this area investigate the evidence. Now, in the case of the Happy John killing, then Mayor Celia Scott forced the release of all the witness accounts and the district attorney's report, which I think is called for in this case as well. That's what they need to do. They need to release all the witnesses' testimony so people can see what people had to say, including what the police officers had to say about how this went down. Simply, suggesting that we did an investigation, so sit down and shut up and go home, doesn't satisfy me, that's for sure. And I don't think it's necessarily going to satisfy a lot of other people either. I don't know if the John Dine investigation is still in the library. It was for a while, but again, that was 20 years ago, and the police department was none too happy with it. It happened because then Mayor Celia Scott insisted on doing it, to her credit. She was a rare mayor in that regard, and though we were not personally on the best of terms, she also was one of the few people who pretty militantly opposed all criminalization actions against homeless people. And she still occasionally comes to city council. I think she was there on Tuesday night when the issues of the Gestapo raids in the Beach Flats happened. So, other thoughts that I have that I've got on this issue. A couple just notes. The names of the other district attorney people investigating this case were not mentioned. The names of the two other people in the room weren't given. Details of the report wasn't given. Some of the language used by the district attorney, Jeff Rosell, concerned me. I wasn't really sure that he was. He did say that there were no other. He did kind of inferentially said there were no other audios and videos available, and that could well be the case. And again, the question comes: there were, then if we don't have that, then let's get the statements of the witnesses, specifically the four officers at least, and the ride along, and perhaps the people from the house, and the people in the different neighborhoods. But now I'm beginning to repeat myself. But these are things that haven't been, well, these demands have not been made on the district attorney's office. And it's, you really kind of got to go along with the narrative. There's, if you look at the video, there's very little that you can see at all. There is some fleeting glance, as I said, of a figure in the upper right-hand corner for about 5 seconds. And if you want to, essentially you're taking the word for the district attorney's office and the officers that all is well. And of course, I asked whether the officers were equipped with body armor, that is to say, with bulletproof vests and other things. And the reason I did that is because if you are heavily armored and someone's coming at you with a rake and you have three other officers supporting you, it may not be the most reasonable decision to shoot somebody dead. In other words, it would be more reasonable if you were simply there in a bathing suit or something, and if you were, you know, if you didn't have any bodily protection. And the way that there was no kind of consideration of that in this report, and indeed, when I asked that question, he didn't even say, yes, they were armored. He said, oh, they officers customarily armor themselves. I mean, it sounded evasive to me, or it sounded like he hadn't even considered that situation. One of the issues that arose in October when 100 or more people gathered at the town clock and then another 100 up at the large church on the hill about this issue and to express, to grieve about it, but also to express some angry concerns that it indicated real deficiencies in the Santa Cruz Police Department, there were concerns that officers were inadequately trained. And I would think the district attorney, he was trying to limit anything he was saying to whether there was a criminal basis or a basis for holding Bailey to account for shooting a disturbed individual dead. Yes, he banged on somebody's house and, oh, he threatened to kill them, what, with his umbrella? Because that's what he was originally armed with. He advanced on the police with a rake. Okay. How far away was he? That seems a rather obvious issue. And again, I'm repeating myself, but maybe that's appropriate for emphasis. That certainly could be mentioned because the police officers know how far away he was. The district attorney knows how far away he was, and yet we're not hearing how far away he was. So that probably is, or it's in the reports, if we could get those reports. Now, of course, I will probably make a Public Records Act request around this, or maybe someone else will. It's a subject of such, has been of such concern, or was at the time, though perhaps not so much anymore, and that may be one of the reasons for the four-month delay. Maybe we'll get some of that information there. I think that was one of the points of the questions asked by the Sentinel reporter, Ryan, I think it's Ryan Masters. Ryan, sorry if I got your last name wrong. About, you know, have you heard of any other rake assaults, or is there any other indication of you know, this being done anywhere else in the country? And the reply of Jeff Rizzo was, well, you know, anything could be a deadly weapon if it's used in a deadly weapon way. And, you know, there was a picture of this rather nasty looking, I mean, it's a metal rake. It's not a sort of a fluffy, puffy wooden rake that, you know, bends back and, is, you know, might give you a scratch or a scrape. It could injure you, you know, that's for sure. But the idea that the question would be, how could the police officers see this and know this in the dark as he was coming at them? Would it have made any difference if he was attacking them with a rake that couldn't be used at all as a weapon against them, except because in this person's, you know, frightened state, he felt he was being attacked and he was attacking back, or he was advancing. The word advancing is what was used. It isn't even stated that Officer Bailey felt in danger for his life, because that might, you know, all we have is sort of these vague statements about officer safety and bodily injury. And I mention all this because I'm still not happy at all with what went down. And these are questions I might have asked the police department when they held their press conference 2 hours later. But an armed officer at the door stopped me from going in, and actually stopped a number of other alternative media journalists, such as John Malkin, Abby Samuels, Keith McHenry, and Wes White from Salinas, from entering. So what I think I'll play you now, and this is really more a sort of a, perhaps what my friend Bob LaMonica might call a rant, but it's really a form of a protest in front of the police department. Before I do, why don't I take a brief musical break so everybody can go get a cup of tea or something and I can have a couple swigs of water. You're tuned to Free Radio, the stream of Free Radio at least, at freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and the name of this show is Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides. As mentioned before, the phone number is 427-3772. 427-3772. Call in if you want. If you have thoughts or comments, has this case bothered you in the last 4 months? Is it sort of a closed book for you? Are you happy with the account that the district attorney gave? I looked in the Sentinel to try to find out if there was a story about the Santa Cruz Police Department's press conference, but there wasn't. There was only something about the DA's press conference. There'll probably be something tomorrow. But though I frankly am not too optimistic about it being any more enlightening than, just not being particularly enlightening at all. So, let's take a musical break. And don't go away, folks.
Thank you. walked down a path so many walked before. An unexpected might and an unwanted war. But it was a moment of pushing a global open door. And the people of the world moved forward. Oh, comrade, we are listening. To your sons of the streets, we are listening. Through the bullets and the bombs, we can still hear you sing. Well, they can crush the flowers, but they can't stop the spring. Your flag for the world to see. As you stood face to face with the military, but your sacrifice and pain, well, it hasn't been in vain. Cause there's a lot more flowers blooming. We are listening. To your sons of the streets, we are listening. Through the bullets and the bombs, we can still hear you sing. Well, they can crush the flowers, but they can't stop the spring. Well, they can crush the flowers, but they can't stop the spring.
And that was Ryan Harvey, Flowers. From 5 years ago, and still, well, still good. So, before I go into the aborted attempt to get into the police department's community room press conference by simply walking in and pointing out that we're media with Free Radio Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz Indie Media and Voices of the Street from Salinas, which is what Wes White represents, and he also has, of course, been on this radio show talking about Salinas activism, his attempt to fight the anti-homeless laws in Salinas, organize Chinatown homeless community, and he's still doing that kind of organizing. But he's also a video journalist, has been over here in Santa Cruz doing a lot of video journalizing. A lot of videoing. He did video the entire Jeff Rozelle press conference. He's going to post it online. So in case you want to see that, not just hear it, you'll be able to do that as well if you're interested. If anyone wants more information about anything that happens on the show, or you want to be a part of the show, or you have news for the show, you can contact me at 423-4833. 423-HUFF, which is also an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is the sometime civil rights group that I pop in and out of, and meets every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe, though not necessarily next Wednesday. You may be having some trouble doing that, but stay tuned. If you're interested in civil rights for poor people and you want to work on the Public Records Act requests and protests around police misconduct, give me a call at 423-4833. So let's hear a little bit of my attempted dialogue with Lieutenant Barry. I think it's Warren Barry, outside the Santa Cruz Community Room, where he was standing with his hand on his gun for a while until after I pointed this out. He graciously moved his hands to his back pocket. And he had a fellow officer there, Officer Gomez, who wouldn't initially identify himself, but Lieutenant Harvey, he was identified eventually. And let's hear some of this. And you can call in if you have any thoughts on it. You're not going to hear much from Lieutenant Barry because he made it a point to say very little and sort of stand there stolidly sort of like a statue blocking the doorway, which, as I understand it, the door was already, maybe it wasn't locked. It seemed to be locked as well, but let's hear some of this.
Did you end, John?
No.
Why not? You're with Free Radio San Jose.
Well, also KZSC, too.
And I'm talking here with Free Radio broadcaster John Malkin, who is also a writer for a number of publications, including Good Times. And he's a radio commentator on KZSC. And he's also an author in his own right. And he does a show on Wednesday evenings, which you can hear. He tried to get in. He was told he couldn't, and he's talking about that here.
I don't have official printed credentials, but Keith
Rosenthal.
He's the station manager. He's gonna hook things up so we can do that. Who at Free Radio Santa Cruz is going to hook things up so we can do that?
Well, we're working on it.
Yeah.
You know, the district attorney had me at the press conference 2 hours ago. I guess the police department is not as transparent as the district attorney's office.
Good.
So, Martine, are you going to direct these officers to let the public in or not?
And that's Martine Bernal, who's really the real kingpin of the city as far as city government goes. He's the city manager, who is really the person who sort of directs the city staff, which the people who really do things or don't do things in the city. The city council is kind of the frontispiece or the fig leaf for the city staff, although you would think in a democracy it would be working the other way.
I guess not. You didn't say anything. So, Lieutenant Berry, are you going to allow the media in? The independent media.
No, you're not coming in.
And why is that, Lieutenant Berry?
I'm not doing interviews today, so that's all.
Well, I'm sorry, that's all doesn't serve me. I'm concerned that the media be allowed in here because it's a public issue, particularly that Free Radio and other people are concerned about.
I've explained. I'm not going to be answering any of your questions, so you're kind of wasting your time talking to me.
So you're continuing to block the doorway so the public can't come in. Is that correct? I see. I can hear your radio, but I can't hear you. And I got a shrug from Lieutenant Berry. So why don't you video this guy? Are you? You are videoing it. Okay, so Lieutenant Berry, this is a very significant issue. Sean Arlt was shot dead by your department, and recently was a district attorney's press conference that we were admitted to, unlike this particular one here, where you're refusing us access. Why is that? I want you to notice that the lieutenant is not answering a perfectly reasonable question. In fact, he didn't answer it before, and he's not answering it now.
Very, very stern-looking fellow, this guy. But
I just want to know, with the list of accredited, how do you get on the accredited list?
And the other voice here is that of Wes White, who is videoing much of this, and maybe posting it along with the Jeff Rozelle interview.
Yeah, who are you letting in, Lieutenant? And you notice that stern demeanor where he again refuses to answer questions.
If you could do me a favor and just take a step back and not put that on my face, I'd be very appreciative of it.
So feel better now?
One more would be a little bit better.
I feel more concerned that you have your hand on your gun and the other hand on your, you know, on your microphone like
Sorry
there.
I feel that way.
Well, wouldn't you feel that way if someone was standing, an armed officer was blocking? Please let us in! We should be allowed access to this media, I think.
Take a step back.
Good luck. I'm not going to break in, Lieutenant. I don't want to get shot like Sean Arlt got shot by your department. I mean, I am not wielding a rake, it's true. Let us in! Anyway, so you're hearing my concerns. I don't want to have to continue protesting out here because I think that it's unnecessary. Perhaps you can advise your superior that there are two media people out here that want to come in. The reason I'm sticking it in your face is because I'm trying to get some kind of an answer from you. And I am keeping it a reasonable distance from
Actually,
you.
Actually, you're a little closer than arm's length, but since I know who you are, I'm not.
Well, that's reasonable, Lieutenant Berry, and I appreciate that.
I don't appreciate, however, you're blocking the way, as you know. And you also have another officer with you. I see you have no pin on your lapel. What's your name, officer?
That is Officer Gomez.
Thank you.
Our Community Services Division.
Okay. Is that right, Officer Gomez?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Courtesy is always something I like to see from people that we pay taxes for. You know, that's my concern in that regard. So this is the community room. We're standing outside. You want to take a look at that? So the community is not being allowed into the community room, apparently, by an armed officer. Notice his hand is still on his gun. Notice that? And are you anticipating an attack, Lieutenant Berry? I mean, are we going to need some vehicles here, perhaps from, you know, Homeland Security? Or what is actually going on? And I know these questions sound provocative, but it is provocative to have your hand on your weapon. I'd feel much more comfortable if you moved your hand away from your weapon. Will you please do that?
If it makes you feel comfortable, I'll put my hand in my back pocket like that. How's that sound?
That feels much better.
Right.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, my cameraman here may be smirking, but...
It's a silly exercise. Unfortunately, you know, we're not accredited, and that's the bottom line. They've been getting orders not to let anybody in other than media, and that's it. Who they deem appropriate.
Well, I can understand that. I would ask simply that, Lieutenant Berry, you ask that if an independent member of the free radio be allowed in. You haven't made that request of anyone inside. That would be my question. Hey, Abby.
Hi.
You have your media credentials?
Oh, you have to. Hi.
I'm
Source. Hey, how are you?
And at this point, Abby Samuels and Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs showed up. And I think John Malkin was still there. He had attempted to get in, of course, and was unsuccessful. And there's a little bit of dialogue between the four of us.
It's only for people with...
Doesn't that seem like...
What about independent? Is Alex DeRossi in there? He's not allowed in there either?
He's not allowed in either. And who is this guy? We don't want your kind around here, sir.
John is not allowed in here?
So.
Hey, Keith, how are you doing? Nice to see you.
So they're banning the independent media from this event. They're refusing to go inside to determine whether accepted independent media like John Malkin of Free Radio, myself, Andy Bay. He also writes for the Good Times.
So what is the rule? What kind of press do you have to be?
Credit media only.
And how do you be
accredited?
You're going to have to go ahead and talk to Joyce. I don't run the accreditations. Yeah.
Well, when you want to discriminate, you put it all in a word.
And actually, Lieutenant Berry didn't ask for any accreditation. We didn't offer any, but he didn't. He just saw us and said, "You can't come in." So, I think the accredited media—I don't want to just say it was simply an excuse. It's a nice cover, but I think that the lieutenant may have made the decision without determining whether we were accredited. In fact, I've been accredited in the past, and I probably still am. I don't usually rely a lot on credentials to try to get into press events. If they're trying to be exclusive, I often prefer to remain outside with others. I don't prefer to be there, but if that's where people are being forced to be, then that's often where I am. But he made no attempt to determine if there was either accredited documentation from either myself or Abby Samuels, Keith McHenry, or John Malkin, although I suppose we may have given the game away by sort of growling about the issue rather than saying, yeah, we're accredited, let us in. We are, I know. Yes, we have been. Whether we have a little piece of paper with us that shows it is not really the issue. Unless the purpose of these officers was to exclude us. Hence, at the district attorney's office, I didn't have to show anything, although you know, they checked with Roselle. Did they know me as a member of the community, was a journalist? Yes, they did. Does Lieutenant Barry know me as that? Yes, he does. He doesn't like what I write. But that's no basis for excluding me or John Malkin or Abby Samuels or Keith McHenry.
Four police officers were, since it's, we're missing it. I know one was...
Bailey, who did the shooting.
Yeah. Who?
Bailey. Officer Bailey.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean... he was a male. He is a male. I presume he's still on the force. The other officers were not named. Actually, that was
one of the people that
I don't know. I know the district attorney had a press conference 2 hours ago, which I was at, which I recorded, which I'll play on free radio along with this interview with Lieutenant Barry, which, you know, which has, in essence, yeah, they didn't name the three other police officers, which I should have asked, because Roselle, who did the interview, was Roselle was forthcoming, but I failed. He answered questions that I asked. He did not have an armed officer stopping me from going into this event, which is a matter of, I think, great public concern. And here's our good times reporter that's not a good times for him, I guess. That's John Malkin, who's just showed up.
They won't let you in?
You want the van?
No. I don't have a...
accredited. You're not accredited.
I don't have a printed...
I should have made...
So if you would have had...
all your articles, you know, he does front page articles.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. But that's...
No, it makes perfect sense. This, they want to keep this as closely...
Transparency. Let's do transparency, 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, they're keeping this a closely concealed event. Stops the public from asking embarrassing questions. And you're colluding with that process, Lieutenant Barry. Are you really happy with that? And Lieutenant Barry is looking the other way, although he is keeping his hands in his back pockets. We will say that for him.
Yeah, look at.
Their media out here who want to come in! So, I just thought I would make that clear to those inside that there are some media that are being kept out.
I saw the four stars peeking out the window there, so they know.
Well, that's good. I want the other media to know, too. Five media people are being kept out! Is something I'm concerned about. Nothing personal.
It's pretty disheartening. This is the way our policies and procedures work.
Right.
That's what you call privately public. Disappointing.
So at least they're not cooperating with Homeland Security as they were doing on Monday at 3:30 in the morning. And I don't know. Were you present at that time, Lieutenant Barry, at 3:30 in the morning in the Beach Flats?
Again, I'm not answering any questions.
And it's interesting that Lieutenant Barry declines to answer any questions. If he is innocent of any kind of wrongdoing, why isn't he answering questions? Can you answer me that, Lieutenant? And he stands silent. You can draw your own conclusions as to what this means.
And actually, that's kind of a joke on my part, because it's often the police department that will tell you if you're being held in custody or they're interrogating you on the street. If you have nothing to hide, then you can answer these questions. You know, if you're innocent, then we can let us search you because you have nothing to hide. And the answer, of course, is that a person's privacy is a very important thing. But Lieutenant Barry is not protecting his privacy. He's concealing information that the public, I think, needs to know about and has a right to know about, that is going on inside that building. And also, his behavior as a police officer is a public issue, not a private one. And therefore, it isn't perhaps too far from the mark to say to him, look, if you're innocent, then talk about it. Because you're not on trial here for a crime, and we're not trying to gather evidence that to take you into custody. Although, perhaps, I guess, if the behavior is bad enough, that might come into it. In any case, here's a little more from the standoff on the steps of the police station.
I have no idea, not having any more information, which seems to be the point of keeping out independent media.
Yeah!
So.
Police state! Police state!
That's, and there are some who are concerned.
That's
this
Keith McHenry.
State. But we have an official of the city who's going in, and media want to come in!
And that was Tina Scholl, the assistant city manager, who demurely stepped into the room past the lieutenant and past Lieutenant Barry, and we were still kept out.
But are being locked out again, apparently. So,
we have to relax here.
So,
as if this is highly sensitive information.
Well, clearly, the lieutenant believes it is highly sensitive information, or he wouldn't be blocking our entranceway to this.
Oh, I mean, gosh, it's almost a non-story. Other than the names of the other officers, I suppose that'd be the only piece, but it's a non-story as it is.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. But you see, there will not be an account of the evasions and omissions that are actually happening at this press conference because there's no independent media to cover it. And that may be why Lieutenant Barry is actually standing here.
Right, stand in line.
Lieutenant Barry, if that's not the case, then you are erring in what you're doing because you're giving that impression to people who are listening, at least to some of my listeners, which is, if there is nothing to hide, why are you blocking the doorway? And we hear some concerns in the distance from activist Keith McHenry. So I've been here about, gosh, what is
I've
it?
I've got 11 minutes on video.
Well,
12.
It's been about 15 minutes, I guess. And it seems clear that unless we wish to put these officers under citizen's arrest for blocking access to a community room public building, on the orders of the police department. It's interesting how many things these days are on the orders of the police rather than justified by any legal concerns. I mean, this is the community room. There is a community event being held here, and we are being blocked from going in.
And been very vocal about wanting to be a part of that process.
Right. Why are you locking the public out? If you have nothing to hide, let the public in, is my thoughts on this. So, and my apologies for having to shout past you, Lieutenant. Nothing personal. And you, Officer Gomez. But I think the message has been communicated. And is there more we should be doing here? Laying down sleeping bags, perhaps?
Well, who knows how long it'll take until they come out?
I don't know. It looks like the some others are arriving, but
they might be coming back to lunch.
Right.
Disappointingly so. Privately public. Who owns the?
Shame on you, Chief Vogel. Is another way of putting it.
You gotta protect yourself from lawsuits, you know. The best way to do that is to make sure nobody gets a word.
Well, remember, this is going out to the mainstream media. I'm sure they'll give you all the facts.
Oh, you're right. Watered-down version in 5 seconds or less?
No, no. I mean, let's not be cynical or critical before we see the coverage that they give. That will be fair.
Oh, we saw the one right outside, you know, in the basement in the cafeteria. We saw that piece. How long did that stay? 15 seconds?
No transparency! No accountability! No good! That's one way of putting it. They have blocked us from going in. They blocked us from going in.
May I go in?
I talked to the guy with the armed, you know, the armed guard.
Sorry, it's only for the media.
I'm with Free Radio. Do you want to say something for Free Radio?
I would rather not. No, I just wanted to hear what's going on.
Yeah, I'm sorry they won't let you in. Yeah. Here, let me give you a card because I did get to the district attorney's event.
We're okay. We're all right. But thank you.
It'll be played tonight at 6 o'clock. Not this, but the district attorney's decision. Right.
Thank you.
And this was, I believe, the sister-in-law of Sean Arnold, or perhaps one of Sean Arnold's parents. She wanted to come in, and they wouldn't let her in either. Pretty sad and pretty infuriating. A little bit more of this, and then we'll get back to a little music and, who knows, maybe a rush of phone calls.
A relative of Sean Arnold has just been refused entrance.
Yeah. And perhaps the sad thing about this is that no one who was inside the building cared enough to walk outside to see what the shouting was about. It was all simply everyone sitting in a row with their hands on their folded on their laps. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't inside. I didn't see that, but I can envision that as what was going on. And it's this is supposed to be a time, hopefully, when people are beginning to stand up, as they did at the Tuesday City Council meeting. And I'm going to be playing probably more of that on Sunday and a longer show when I do a 9:30 to 1 o'clock show, or maybe later. But this is a time when people need to break out of their inhibitions in terms of their kowtowing to authorities that are actually not interested in justice. They're interested in justifying what they've done and justifying a continuing course of action that will probably involve a repetition of this kind of thing, particularly if they're not held accountable.
I guess this is how democracy works in Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz Police Department style.
Well, we can stay here and see what other victims and interested people are being turned away by these two officers who are, I don't think, acting in a fashion that really reflects might be their natural human responses. Instead, they're like robots, I'm afraid, obeying orders. Not unlike the people who perhaps raided the beach flats and terrorized people 3 days ago. And, of course, we'll hear nothing from these gentlemen about that, because the lieutenant, unless you want to say something, Lieutenant Berry?
No.
No, he shook his head again. So, shall we concede defeat and leave these two officers?
I'd like to hear what information transpires that anybody would be willing to filter out for us.
Well, I'm sure the Sentinel will have a splendid account of what went down. They did such good recording.
Why aren't you supporting your fellow reporters? Hypocrites!
Is another way of putting it.
Well, that's the American way, right? I mean, hey, I got in. You should be able to get in on your own, too.
Oh, for you mean for the report?
And that was some of the monologue, a little bit of a dialogue, out front of the Santa Cruz Police Department this afternoon, as myself and activist and video journalist Wes White and a few other people occasionally stood outside trying to either get into the meeting or make clear our displeasure at not being let in, the meeting being a four-month delayed press conference by Chief Vogel's Santa Cruz Police Department on the slaying of Sean Arlt in October, where he was reportedly wielding a rake against four defenseless officers who decided they had to shoot him dead. Actually, they didn't decide. They probably just reacted, but who've taken no real responsibility for that, at least not in any direct way to the community and the people who are particularly concerned about it, at least not in my book. Let's hear a little more from Ryan Harvey. Thank you.
mistakes you try to make, and in those moments you push, but in the end sometimes you felt that you did much. I saw a couple thousand people build a home here, in the shadow of the greed of the governor, and like water that rose, your ideas flowed, and they made their way to the square, and they brought 100,000 people there. Hey, it was constant, you captured my heart. You gave me hope the way you fought. You sparked something and you opened the door. Cause it's a fair moment and you made it yours. A little so important what you did. You gave us all something that we needed. And looking from here, now it might take years till we realize its full importance. How it inspired its participants. How it danced outside of politics. How it altered public consciousness. How it built a future movement. How it broke us fellow silence. How it gave us all some guidance. And hey, Wisconsin, you captured my heart. You gave me hope the way you fought. You sparked something and you opened the door. Took that moment and you made it yours. Took that moment and you made it yours. Cause every revolution has a context. And social change is a process. I saw the sunrise to melt the snow, to clear the land for more life to grow, and it's spring now. Oh, it's spring now. Oh, it's spring now. And hey, Wisconsin, you captured my heart. You gave me hope the way you fought. You sparked something and you opened the door. Cause it took that moment and you made it yours. Took that moment and you made it yours. Took that moment and you made it ours. And it's spring now.
And that was one from an Ryan Harvey album, again available on Internet, Songs from the Global Uprisings. And that may be it for Ryan Harvey, but it isn't it for us at the moment. A bunch of things are happening in the next few days, at least I've noticed, advertised, and that sound like they're interesting. Might be of interest to you folks out there. Let's look over some of them and see what I can bring to your attention here. Well, this evening, if I can find it, let's see here. Well, I'll begin with what I know. Tomorrow, from 4 to 7, February 17th, in the Loudoun Nelson Community Center room, there's going to be a national general strike discussions. Organized Santa Cruz invites the public to get involved with their local community. They're going to gather organizing groups from across the county to plan a way forward in the resistance to the Trump administration. That's starting at 4 p.m. Loudoun Nelson Center, 5 p.m. for a conversation about turning Santa Cruz County into a genuine sanctuary for all. Homeless people take note, although it's not really been a part of any of these immigration rallies. It's, if somebody brings it up, as I did at the Tuesday discussion outside the city council, where people actually started, I think, moving in the right direction by organizing outside the city council and recognizing that talking to them was an exercise in futility and perhaps even more a waste of time in a very fundamental sense. Both wasting time and giving inappropriate acknowledgement to an authority that should not be regarded as an authority, giving them more power than they should have. And again, this is a discussion tomorrow between 4 and 7, February 17th, of a bunch of groups, and these include Democratic Socialists of America, End Solitary Santa Cruz, the Hub for Sustainable Living, Medicare for All, Santa Cruz for Bernie, NAACP Santa Cruz, Organized Santa Cruz, People's Disco, Print Organized Protest, Resource Center for Nonviolence, Rising Tide, Sanctuary Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz International Women's Strike, Santa Cruz Solidarity Network, Socialist Alternative, Sub Rosa, UCSC Graduate Student Union, Warming Center Program, and more. And indeed, who knows, maybe a Huff member or two will show up there and see what's cooking with this group. I'm always wary of these discussions that are sort of an endless process of chat rather than actually doing anything, but there seems to be a lot of energy around, so who knows, maybe people will begin to do something. And again, check it out, Loudon Nelson, 4 o'clock tomorrow. The next day, on the 18th, on Saturday, I think I may have mentioned this in my previous show, according to the Santa Cruz Indie Media calendar, there's a Black Lives Matter corner stand in Capitola at the four corners of Capitola Road and 41st Avenue. And that organizer is Phoebe, whoever she may be. And she said, the Women's March was a great success, and many black women and activists issued poignant critiques about why it didn't work for them. I may be reading a little of that. One of the primary critiques expressed by many was that white women are only now showing up because their rights are being threatened. Where was the unity, quote-unquote, when Sandra Bland, Trayvon Martin, Yvette Smith, Rakia Boyd, or other numerous black folk were wrongly killed or injured by police? So how can white people be in better integrity around this idea of unity? One easy step is to answer the call and put our bodies out there in a visible way for Black Lives Matter. The event is open to all. We want to especially encourage white allies to show up. And again, that's 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, at Capitola Road and 41st Avenue. And there's a little more in this description. We will gather our Black Lives Matter signs at the corners of 41st and Capitola. It's a nonviolent, peaceful, family-friendly event. But please keep in mind that if you're bringing little kids, it is a busy intersection. We suggest bringing a stroller and activities for them. We have every legal right to stand on a public sidewalk. We can't block it, but we can stand. We aren't pretending this is going to magically fix racism, but it does help to increase cultural pressure on white folks to stand up for black lives, show the local black community they have our support, send a message to the police that we're watching them and we'll hold them accountable for racial discrimination, increase your integrity as a white activist, and teach your kids to stand up for what is right. Push through any fear and discomfort you may have and join us. Let's get visible and move and be more inclusive. And I actually have kind of a report of my own. For a year, I've been trying to get racial stats from the Santa Cruz Police Department, and they've refused to give them, using a variety of excuses and pretexts. Finally, I guess it was today, I went into the police station to find out. I'd gotten a note finally from Bren Lehrer, or perhaps Bonnie Bush, who are the city administrator and the assistant city administrator, respectively. And I was told, okay, you can go down to the police station, and we won't give you the records as to the race of particular people that were given tickets, even though that's on the citation and could be easily been made a part of the record, which they've made. You've got to go find that out yourself. So this is reversing something that they had been doing about 2 years ago. 3 years ago, we went and complained about possible racial profiling on Pacific Avenue, and we were told that we couldn't get the stats unless we looked through all the citations ourselves, and we had a team of six people who did that. We published our results on Indy Media, and one of them was a concern about a particular officer, Bradley Barnett, who was ticketing black folks downtown at a rate of, I think it was 7 times their occurrence in the population. And, for minor offenses, sitting near a building, smoking on Pacific Avenue, things of that sort. But then shortly after that, when I again requested the, then they began giving us, they apparently didn't like us in the police station, so going through all their tickets to find out what the race of each particular person ticketed was, they decided they would publish the racial stats as part of the general matrix, which they were putting out, saying, here's a chart which shows who was listed, who was arrested when, where, what their address was, what their race was, and so forth. But then they stopped doing this. Then about a year later, they refused to do this. They gave me a matrix, but it was missing. The list was missing the address and the race of people. And, of course, this is very relevant, particularly if you're a homeless activist, because you want to know where our tickets being given out in a discriminatory fashion to poor people, for homeless people, to unhoused folks. And, of course, if they omit the address, you can't tell what's going on. So I requested this be included, and I got a number of demands that I show credentials as a journalist, that I swear I wouldn't divulge the information to anyone else, a whole series of ridiculous and previously unknown demands. And they're not justified at all by the Public Records Act. I mean, it seems unworthy of the police department of the city of Santa Cruz that they would do this. But then again, have they ever been worthy of anything, really? I mean, I like to put that into my letters to them. We wouldn't want people to think that you were trying to conceal something, when, of course, it's hard to draw any other conclusion other than maybe they don't like the person who's making the request and they want to make it as difficult as possible. In any case, I went into the police department today. This was before all this brouhaha, I think. Maybe it was yesterday. Yeah, I think it was. I think it was yesterday. Anyways, in the last few days. And I asked for the records, and they said, okay, well, you know, our record room is full right now, but, you know, we can try. I said, well, look, I'll be back in a few days. Do it when you've got some space and time, and I've got some more people with me. I just want to know, are you going to can I come in and do it and on short notice? They said, yeah, although it'd be good if you let us know in the morning. Well, it was either this morning or yesterday that I got a letter from the police records person that says, you will have to renew your credential as a journalist by giving us a sworn statement. And you might think, well, what's the big deal? You know, give them a sworn statement. And I may well do that. But this is outrageous, because a person, any member of the public who wants to look at these police records should be allowed to do so. And there's nothing in the law that prevents it. This is simply an attempt to make it more difficult and make the police activity less transparent. Maybe it's to assert a kind of privilege and to demand a kind of undue respect for a department that, insofar as it does these things, does not deserve respect. It deserves disrespect. And that so does the city council, and so does every other public agency that does this kind of thing. And we tend to get trapped up in saying, well, my friend Wes White was saying, well, let's change the policy. Let's just change the law. And that's not doesn't sound like an unreasonable suggestion. You know, we are a government of laws and not of men or not of people. So we just have to change the laws and things are going to be better. Well, I think unless you confront head on the fundamental profound corruption that has set in and tends to set in with people who are in privileged positions and a structure that encourages that kind of privilege, that going after individual laws, of course, it's kind of hopeless to go after laws in Sacramento generally, is a false road to lead people down. I mean, the Santa Cruz City Council did not, because people decided to go change the law or ask that the beg of Christopher Crone and the City Council that they let people speak at a when they came into the City Council on Tuesday, they stopped the meeting and said, you're not going anywhere until you let us speak. And so suddenly the City Council hastily withdrew, conferred. Acting Mayor, Vice Mayor David Terrazas came out and said, well, no, all is well, you know, don't worry, we can if people want to have a discussion, we'll move the item up. You know, they were politely requested, they refused. When the mob of people came in chanting and clapping their hands and would not leave, they suddenly became much more amenable. Now, when a group of people did this in 1993 regarding homeless people, chanting homes, not jails, then Mayor Rotkin, or actually he was a council member at the time, I think, started yelling at us that we were fascists. Actually, I wasn't doing the shouting. I was a more soft-spoken person in those days, but others who were the group Homes, Not Jails weren't. And the city council called out a police force of a couple dozen people, moved everybody out, blocked the doors, wouldn't let people back in. This time, however, maybe there's a certain sensitivity to the fact that people are becoming a little wary of the word fascism because the Democrats are throwing it around freely now that their little proto-fascist Hillary Clinton hasn't gotten into power, and the other guy, who's a little more outspoken in his fascist rhetoric, has, and they're throwing the word fascist around, and so maybe the city council is getting a little nervous about this. I would hope that all these authorities are getting a little nervous about this. Anyway, I will now be required to, I will be delayed further in getting information around what's cooking with race and class profiling in Santa Cruz by the Santa Cruz Police Department. Incidentally, if you want to help with this project, give me a call off air at 423-4833. I could use some help. If only just moral support, pat on the back, I don't know, soft songs, if you want to play a guitar, whatever. And this should happen in the next week or two. I'm going to be going in to do some reviewing of the records. We needed to really do this last year when the sleeping ban itself finally was up for a kind of a pro forma vote. Don Lane finally admitted the obvious that sleep is not a crime and it's time to get off his pretense that it was, because that's been his position for the last 20 years as he attempts to help the homeless on various boards and so forth. So I'm going to be playing a lot of audio from the Santa Cruz City Council meeting of Tuesday on Sunday when I come back, and we'll go into it in greater detail then. What I'm going to play now is some voices from the street, or actually, I think we're talking about the Red Church last Monday. That's the Calvary Episcopal Church where folks come and have a meal once a week on Monday night, provided they don't take their food out of the building. We have a goon squad guy at the door who stops them from doing that, provided they don't try to sleep by the side of the building at night. The Calvary Episcopal Ministries call the police on them if they do that. Although they are very, very charitable to 20 people they let inside the building and have for the last year or two or longer with the Association of Faith Communities, but that's 20 people. And there are, 1,000 to 2,000 people in the city of Santa Cruz and probably more than two or three times that number in the county, and the number is growing. And it's not because Santa Cruz is such a wonderful place to come to. It's such that rents are... It's such a wonderful place for landlords to charge huge amounts of money to renters, and a wonderful place for city councils to authorize the building of condos and some low-income housing, but no significant rental housing for people. So you just can't, middle class getting squeezed way out. And meanwhile, homeless people are illegal if they sleep at night in Santa Cruz, which is something I always... Well, I probably should have worn my bathrobe today when I went down to these press conferences, but I didn't. I'm not sure whether I was afraid of getting it wet or tripping over the tie or just trying to act respectable. Hard to say what my problem was today. So I don't think there is something happening tonight, if I can find out what it is. Well, today was a day without immigrants, and I haven't really received any reports on that. That was happening throughout the country in different places, presumably rather strongly in Watsonville. If anybody has a report, please call in 427-3772. There's a story on Indy Bay. Raids on Santa Cruz immigrant communities caused severe damage. Eyewitness and on-the-ground accounts from those directly affected by the recent pre-dawn raids launched by Homeland Security and the Santa Cruz Police Department on Monday, the 13th of February. Monday the 13th. What sounded like a garbage truck at first in the dark hours of the morning turned out to be a nightmare for many families in the Beach Flats, Lower Ocean, and Live Oak neighborhoods Monday morning. Beach Flats residents report hearing helicopters overhead, and flash grenades were cast into several homes, while an unidentified voice, no indication of jurisdiction, on a loudspeaker demanded that 136 Lee Brandt come out with your hands on head, blared. This caused confusion because 136 Lee Brandt is the address to the entire Nueva Vista Community Apartments complex. That's the project that threw out more low-income immigrants and undocumented workers and local Santa Cruz residents than it housed. It was a pet project of Catherine Byers and other so-called progressive activists on the city council who ignored the pleas of the residents there that they not be evicted from the Dolphin and Lee apartments, which were torn down to make way for the Nueva Vista community apartments. This was back around 2001. But jumping forward to 2017, it's the Homeland Security outside blaring, "Come out with your hands on your head." Several streets were blocked off by armored vehicles, including SCPD's Bearcat. I repeat again, SCPD's Bearcat. While heavily armed officers in combat gear from the Department of Homeland Security, aided by the Santa Cruz Police Department, began banging on multiple doors and pried open an apartment door with a crowbar. Neighbors witnessed a family of three, including an 11-year-old girl, detained in handcuffs for over 2 hours as DHS tore through the apartment, confiscating phones and demanding identification. All three were released. Hang on a second. Let me find this again. All three were released upon providing their IDs, passports, and TPS cards. Not sure what those are. One of the detainees told a neighbor that they were intimidated by officers after telling the officers that the person being sought after did not live at that address. The officers threatened to charge them with accessory. "It was tough to watch," said an eyewitness. "Just the lack of dignity allowed for a family that did not have anything to do with or have any knowledge of any crime." A mental health crisis response team was notified immediately afterwards by neighbors. Despite the three detainees in the Beach Flats being released, there is considerable damage left in the wake of a poorly informed, mishandled, and extremely damaging raid. Just a few miles east at the same time, families in the Corcoran apartments near 17th Avenue were driven out of their homes with flashbang grenades, and windows were smashed in. A man with a work visa was taken, leaving behind his wife, toddler, and an infant. The man was mistakenly arrested for having the same first and last name as the target suspect. After an attempt to charge the man with extortion, he was released after a court hearing on Wednesday morning, along with three others, who were also mistakenly arrested. The series of raids in Santa Cruz and Watsonville have coincided with hundreds of ICE raids happening throughout the country this week. In the larger context of a national crisis around mass incarceration, for-profit prisons, and hyper-criminalization of communities of color, bigger questions demand analysis. What is the real impact of these militant arrests on already vulnerable communities? We are hearing the same story. Officers are coming in with more weapons than they're confiscating, ready to take on El Chapo, when that's just not the reality, says a Beach Flats resident. The force is excessive, and the fact that they are entering the wrong homes makes their investigation questionable. It's clear these are scare tactics. It's problematic to couch this as all is justifiable because of criminal activity, says another Beach Flats resident who witnessed the raid. We know the gang tracking system is faulty. There are kids categorized in the gang database without proper investigation. When asked about the MS-13 gang activity in the Beach Flats area, one father said, 10 or 15 years ago they were here. Now I haven't seen any here. Here, all I see are kids. To learn more and get involved with efforts in the Santa Cruz Sanctuary, in Santa Cruz to ensure sanctuary for undocumented immigrants, and there's an address, sanctuary-sc.net. And I'm going to check that out right now and see if there's anything more on that website. And there doesn't seem to be Let's take a second look here. There is a website, Sanctuaries Sanctuario Santa Cruz, One Community, Una Comunidad. And that's at sanctuary-sc.net/contact/. And there's a form to fill out there, I guess, if you want to provide sanctuary for folks. Again, tomorrow there's a meeting about pushing back. I think it's not just about sanctuary, but other issues, too. Sanctuary is probably a big part of them at the Loudoun Nelson Center at 4, and the Black Lives Matter movement, insofar as it's happening here, which hasn't been happening at all much that I've seen. Instead, we have timid protests about police shootings, and then some very, very sparsely attended protests. I was involved in those protests at the town clock around the killing of Sean Arlt and Luke Smith by the various police agencies in our area. But who knows? Maybe on Saturday folks will come out. I'm going to hope to check that out myself. But unfortunately, I'm not seeing. There was some event that was happening tonight, and doggone it, I don't know exactly what it was. And, here it is. It's actually happening now, and it goes on until 9 o'clock. It's at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History, and it's run by a couple of groups. I guess it's the SCORE is one of them, the Santa Cruz County Community to Combat Racism. I probably have that wrong, but that's the general idea. And there's a second organizer. It's a free film, I believe, which you can still see an hour's worth of if you get there, or at least perhaps join in a discussion or meet some folks of like mind. Let's see if I can give you more about that. Let's see here. And looking more closely, it's called Cracking the Codes and the System of Racial Inequality. Apparently, it's the name of a film screened as part of a community dialogue and conversation on race. The event is open and free, and it's at 705 Front Street in Santa Cruz at the Museum of Art and History. And it's they're going to examine social determinants, history, identity, and culture, internal components, bias, privilege, internalized racism, external relationships, interpersonal, institutional, and structural. And in the past few years, I've been kind of skeptical. I haven't been to these kinds of discussions, and so I'm really in no position to criticize them. But if they take the place of the direct pressure against the offending agencies like the police and the courts and the district attorney's office, then they are a diversion. And they're a way of people to convince themselves they're doing something when they're not. So that's always been a concern of mine about SCORE, this group that for a decade has sucked money around to investigate racism and hire people and get computers and computer space. And initially, they were going to be looking into all kinds of complaints about racial behavior by police agencies in Santa Cruz County and city. And they compiled all kinds of reports and then did absolutely nothing about them. And my attempts to get this rectified through Simba Kenyatta, who was a longtime activist with them, and then Dennis Etler, who was involved with that group, and others, has led nowhere. So it's like... I don't want to say it's like the Democratic Party, because that's a horrible insult, but it's like the Resource Center for Inaction or Nonviolence. It's very nice, and it provides space for people to come and do their events. It's sponsored events that helped the Freedom Sleepers. It allowed Free Radio Santa Cruz to meet there in a regular way. But in terms of combating police violence locally, not a chance. Not a chance. And that's something we have to understand and recognize. There was an interesting comment by a guy who is normally a severe critic of mine, Razor Ray, he calls himself, and he's commenting on the Day Without Immigrants, which I'm going to see if I can find anything about that online. But there probably was a lot about that. Day Without Immigrants, here it is. Shuts down businesses nationwide. And it's, CNN has a lot of, well, at least has a couple of stories about it. How would the U.S. deal without immigrants for a day? Cities across the country got a taste of that today as businesses shut down and immigrants refused to spend money on a day without immigrants. In an effort to show the Trump administration how much immigrants contribute to the country's economy, as the president continues his tough, I would say, fascistic stances on immigration, similar to the ones Obama had, but worse. And while many immigrants and business owners refused to work in an act of solidarity, others marked the event in more unorthodox ways. Here are some of their stories. Restaurant workers do double the work in advance. Matt Carr, owner of the Little Red Fox restaurant in Washington, had no problem letting his immigrant employees strike, even though they're vital to his business. We have three prep cooks on strike today for a day without immigrants. They're all parents worried about their families and futures, Carr said. But before these workers went on strike, they made sure the business was taken care of, and they prepared all the salads and so forth. I don't know if we can call that much of a strike, but the commentary, however, that I'm talking about, read as follows. And there is a picture that Razor Ray posts of a sign. It's kind of hard to read. Walnut Avenue Cafe will be closed for business Thursday, February 16th, and to essentially memorialize a day without immigrants. And here's what Razor Ray writes. The Walnut Avenue Cafe was closed today in honor of a day without immigrants. Next day you can afford it. Go have breakfast there. They deserve your biz. Now I have a few words to say about U.S. immigration policy. And he and I are in complete agreement on this, but and it's nothing really new and specific about Santa Cruz. But he says, the inscription at the base of the Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. It doesn't say, give us your hired thugs and people who interpreted tortured screams of their fellow countrymen in a CIA secret prison, does it? It doesn't say, give me your economic elite and the people who have corporate connections to fast-tracked high H-1B visas, does it? Fuck America's mercenaries and the economic elite of other nations who often make more money than thousands of other people in their usually impoverished countries combined, where most of the interest of the Democratic Party in immigration issues lies and always has. We need economic immigrants. Unless you happen to know some white people willing to work sun up to sun down 7 days a week until harvest is done out in Pajaro, or willing to get blood and gristle spattered working at a Tyson or Armour meatpacking plant in bumfuck Ohio, in Iowa. Economic immigrant made America great, not the Pentagon's thugs and lackeys they extricate and then support with U.S. tax dollars. Signed, Razor Ray, grandson of Eastern European Central Asian Jews. And that's on Santa Cruz Indie Media. And it looks like I may have gone up against the clock here. I think I have. So what I'm going to do is mellow out with a little music to end the show with. And plus a few comments. I may have said this before, just to make sure I haven't forgotten it, though. Brent Adams, or Big Drum Brent, as I called him, because he used to be a drummer on Pacific Avenue, published a video that showed city workers taking sleeping bags and other survival gear. Actually, it was specifically a sleeping bag from that was left on the levee, and Brent Adams was saying, "Why are you taking that? Why, that's somebody's sleeping bag. Leave it there." And he said, "It's trash. It's garbage." And no, it's not trash. And eventually, actually, Brent talked the guy into leaving it there. But the idea, the point is that it's city policy, or was, I think it was 6 months ago when he, or less, when he showed that video, when he posted it, took it, and so forth, and showed it. One activist pointed out to me that he thought it was rangers and not city workers, but in fact, it is city workers. So if you're still checking out that video, that's my understanding of what's gone down with that. And it hasn't changed, unfortunately. It's still being done. Homeless people are still being harassed. It's Sleep Out 84, and I may be able to get an eyewitness account for Sunday. I'm not sure. The rangers arrived, and we're still harassing people. One activist, Maxwell Green, was arrested at midnight, held until 6, and then released, I think for non-payment of some camping ticket or some such thing. Max has been a guy who's come over every Freedom Sleep for the last 2 or 3 months that I can remember, and spent time there serving food with Food Not Bombs. Freedom Sleepers, of course, for those who don't remember or know, I'm sure you probably remember if you've heard it before, but they are people who every Tuesday night sleep out in front of City Hall and risk harassment and arrest and pneumonia and everything else because they want to end the city's law that criminalizes homeless people for the act of falling asleep. They actually want to end a lot more than that, all the laws that criminalize homeless people, and essentially terrorize the rest of the community into doing whatever the employers want them to do, whatever landlords tell them to do, because their alternatives are to end up on the street and being treated like the rangers and police treat their survival gear, like bags of garbage. Although it's not always that way, and it often doesn't look that way, but it's so frequently and regularly that way, or there's so much of that happening, that really has to be the description as to how homeless people are treated. And you see it in the cruel structure of the laws around the library and within the library and all around the parks. Other places that homeless people went to for sanctuary, now it's more important that dogs be allowed to do dog walks there. And I'm thinking here of Berkeley, Oakland, where a village was built right after the Trump inauguration was destroyed by the city, because neighbors complained they weren't able to walk their dogs there in the park. And I think we're going to leave it there. Let's see. I'm still looking for information from Councilmember Chris Crone and some action on demanding that Wells Fargo, that we disinvest the city's funds from Wells Fargo. That's part of the concern about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, where the Israelis are occupying Palestinian land with settlements. There was a rent control victory, apparently, up in Richmond. Brief story on that, confirming 30 years of legal precedent. This Monday, Honorable Judge Craddock denied the California Apartment Association's motion for an injunction to stall rent control and just cause for eviction in Richmond, Measure L. The implementation of Measure L will now continue with the appointment of a rent board. Measure L passed with 65% support, but the California Apartment Association filed a lawsuit asking for an injunction against the implementation. Landlords regularly argue that rent control laws impinge their constitutional rights, an argument rejected by courts for decades. In this case, CAA tried yet again to argue that the rent control law caused irreparable harm to Richmond landlords, justifying a preliminary injunction stopping the rent control law. The court squarely rejected this argument that the landlords suffer